Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Modern. I'm your host, That Damn Pipsqueak, and I'm joined today by Herzy Quirzy and Scribble. One thing that we're going to do today, the thing that we're doing today is we're going through some of MSEM's older sets. Every set here is at least 2 years old. Some are as old as the format. And we're going to be each picking a card that hasn't really seen play or hasn't seen play recently from the set. As kind of a sleeper and or a card that we think has a lot of potential to be brewed around. So without further ado, we're going to start off with Path of Shadows, or PSA, which is a set by Time Spiraled. This is one of MSEM's oldest sets. I believe it was in the format from the beginning. Herzy can correct me if I'm wrong, though.
I'm pretty sure that's accurate.
I'll go first, I suppose. So the pick that I made is... Doshiro, Master of Dragonsteel, who is a kind of goblin welder-like, but only for equipment. I think this card is like actually kind of really screwed up on paper, since we have good equipment with ETBs. So being able to loop Death Mask that causes people to discard cards with the Harpoon that destroys a creature or planeswalker on ETB feels like you could grind out a lot of fair decks that way. And one-drop creatures just like... so eminently affordable as a possibility.
Yeah, I saw this one when I was scrolling through the set, and I considered putting this as my nomination, so I could definitely agree with that one. It does a lot of impact for a one-drop, and I think we have enough redundancy in our equipment effects where it's just, even if the one-drop dies, you're still doing some pretty powerful stuff with your equipment, so they're not just sitting around waiting for an engine.
The question I would have to do, the hoop that everyone have to figure out while deck building is figuring out, like, making a deck that works with these cheap creatures and equipment, but also one that gets equipment into the yard semi-consistently in order for this to actually start doing its loop, because you need a target to get it started.
Yeah, I do wonder if you need to find some slot for either looting effects or if there's like an artifact sack outlet we could run. One other card that I think is definitely worth considering here is Legacy War Mask from Scriptures of Urshad, which is a 2-mana equipment that when it enters the battlefield, you can... unearth a creature card with mana value 2 or less. So that allows you some redundancy to pick this back up.
You talked about a looting effect, and I'm not going to go into too much detail because I'm pretty sure the sport of what you're going to bring up later, but there is that equipment that sacks artifacts.
Yeah, I actually skipped that because I had already started the conversation in about it. All right, Scribble, why don't you go next?
Hey, when I got this assignment, I endeavored for at least one of my picks to be a common, because I thought that would be funny. And actually, I landed on that on our first set. So the card I landed on was Jedi Clairvoyant, which is a 4-mana creature for 2/2 blue. Human Wizard, it's a 1/1. When it enters the battlefield, create a 2/2 colorless spirit creature token. And whenever a colorless creature enters the battlefield under your control, you may draw a card. I was kind of shocked to see this as a common, because it seems like a pretty sweet draw engine. It's at base a 1/1 and a 2/2 and a card draw for 4 mana, and then if it sticks around, it's drawing you a card whenever you play a colorless creature, which doesn't seem too difficult to do with some kind of artifact list, spawning out a bunch of 1/1 artifact servo tokens or that sort of thing. I can think there's probably some really nice things in sets like Discoveries of Akivia, that just spew out those tokens, get you a lot of card draw. Some Time Spiral sets also, I think the 0-mana 1/1 creature, that works with this as well. And also, it's already gotten you a 2/2 and drawn you a card by the time it's entered just on its own. And it is a pretty big removal magnet, so you've already gone 3-for-1, even if it does get removed instantly, which seems like a pretty high floor.
Technically, they can deny you the card draw by killing it in response to the first ETB. But even then, you're still 2-for-1-ing. This card's also kind of a messed up card to clone, because the first time you get another 2/2 and draw 2 cards. So that feels potentially really rough to play against.
Now, cloning would probably be pretty expensive, because those are also tend to be moderately high on the curve.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get what you mean. That in multiples, yeah, it's a lot of cards are going on.
All right. Herzy, what is your pick?
My pick is also a similar to yours, Pip, a 1-mana red creature, and it is Kamito Eternalist. Costs a single red mana. It's a 1/2 with prowess, and you may activate inscribe abilities from your graveyard as though they were in your hand.
Whoa!
And I saw this and was like, oh, so this is a 1/2 one drop with prowess that effectively just draws you cards as long as you're running moderately okay in scribe cards. And some of the ones that stand out for that, like Searing Script would be your cheap interaction. The Shock that has inscribed, that inscribed cost is kind of up there. But there are a couple that have cheap inscribed costs, like Inner Thoughts and Blue to draw a card, and Forbidden Brew in black to make the opponent lose 2 life. Both of those cost 1 mana and have 2 mana inscribes. So both those are really easy to cast and or scribe normally and then recur later with this Kamito. And then you just build a probably a prowess-esque list around this based around being able to cast all these inscribed cards every turn. Yeah, because Kamito just effectively draws you a bunch of cards once you get it going as a one drop.
Yeah, the curve on this, it's initially seemed a bit weird to me because if you're playing that on turn one and then you're casting your Inner Thoughts turn two, inscribe it. But it seems kind of reminiscent of Dreadhorde Arcanist, a bit closer to that, where it can be a later play. And then once you have a bit more mana all at once, you can really get an engine going. And then you can inscribe multiple things in the same turn, which seems pretty potent.
Mm-hmm. I was initially shocked to see this card because it was like, We have seen, or, you know, if you go years and years back, Blue's Eclipse used to play a kind of inscribed tribal deck. And I was like, why have I never seen this before? And I scrolled down, and the answer is, it was actually only added to the format middle of last year. Because
it's one of the rework cards.
Yeah, it's one of the reworks where it replaced one of the goblins that used to be in the set.
I didn't notice that either.
Instigator having that changelog, really neat right now.
Very helpful.
Time slipping us some last minute.
Or is that mean I cheated from the start of format thing? Dang.
Okay, the next setup is the first ever wildcard set, The Unraveling. Scribble, what is your pick from The Unraveling?
This is
by Water the Weeds or Just Nobody.
This is not the set that I expected to struggle the most for this, finding a card to build around, given how the whole gimmick of The Unraveling is to include a bunch of crazy build around cards where there's no obvious, key to unlock the puzzle, but there's just a lot of open-endedness, a lot of options for building around them. And I actually quite struggled with this one because I think a lot of the pieces have already had those keys discovered, so they've already been built around a lot. So there's not a ton left that I could see that hasn't been tried already. I ended up settling on Orb of Undoing, which I it's a bit similar to something else that seems some play or used to see more play, which is Rippling Curtain. So this is a 3-mana artifact with whenever another non-playant permanent enters the battlefield under your control, return that permanent to its owner's hand at the beginning of the next end step. This seems reminiscent to Rippling Curtain, where it's kind of a flicker enabler, where it allows you to re-trigger your ETBs of your cheap cards every turn. There's an enchantment in the same set called Pyromancer's Knack, which is an enchantment for 2 mana that deals two damage to something whenever it enters or leaves the battlefield, so this would trigger it twice in a turn cycle. Something that I liked about this that it offered over Rippling Curtain was synergies with things that have end of the battlefield triggers, but they're dependent on being cast. So I was thinking with, say, Laybearer Ambitions, lets you hand attack your opponent every single turn in a way that Rippling Curtain doesn't allow you to do. It also seems like it does a pretty decent job of keeping you your threats protected from sorcery speed removal and wraths, so you can play a cheap planeswalker every turn. It's always protected from sorcery speed removal and maybe some haste creatures as well, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I also saw this while I was looking through, and I thought that it works with a lot of the same cards that a lot of the Caitlyn decks did. Well, not the aggro ones, like in terms of Terramorphous Globe and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a pretty nice flicker outlet like that. Yeah.
The issue if you can't fill the board. Sorry, I keep cutting you off.
No. One of the things that seeing this card makes me want to do, though, is MSCM has a couple of donate effects, and this is a card that I really want to put onto the battlefield under my opponent's control.
That would also be rude, yeah.
Actually,
you try to do both, so, even.
Yeah. When I was looking in this set for a card, actually, because I knew a lot of cards in The Unraveling had already been built around at some point, I searched for Orb of Undoing in the MSCM2 channel and just looked at some of the discussion about it. And one of the most recent messages referencing it is a message from you, Pip, in deck building in 2020. And it says, also, Orb of Undoing is really bad, at least in MSM. Don't run it.
I'm not going to say that I don't stand by that statement, but...
I think that was pre its workout, so rework. I think it got reworked, and I think your message was from before reworked.
I also like the framing of one of the most recent messages, 2020.
So the Unraveling card I want to talk about was a card that we actually almost nerfed before its release. But I think this is one that we managed to escape. It's Patient Aethermage. So for one blue-blue, it's a 1/2. Whenever you cast an instant spell during your main phase, copy that spell. You may choose new targets for the copy. So, like, this is a kind of insane amount of value slash, you know, potential tempo advantage. There's some really good cheap instants in our format, and casting them at sorcery speed in a lot of cases isn't, like, a huge downside. You know, if you cast this and then a Void Flare, you don't actually feel bad that, oh no, I cast a Void Flare at sorcery speed if it's dealing 6 damage. The one thing that's, like, kind of awkward is 1/2 body for 3 mana is, like, incredibly vulnerable to literally everything. So that feels a little clunky to use, potentially. But it does look like the potential upside for it is, like, really scary.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, this feels like a pretty nice engine just with a deck full of 1 mana ins. Play it as a turn 4 play. If it survives, then you get to double your entire turns with spells next turn.
Yeah, that's a good point. If you do it as a turn 4 play, you're basically guaranteed to get the copy out of it. You can't kill it before you get priority to cast.
Correct, yeah. So, yeah. At the very least, the Void Flare option is going to be there. Mm-hmm. All right, Herzy, what's your pick for the Unraveling?
I was initially thinking of trying something with the reworked Dreamsight Well and Conjure cards, but I eventually decided, in honor of Civil joining us today, the card I chose is Eye of the Barricade, which costs 3 generic and a white, and it is a 3/3 Vigilance. I won't lie, that body is terrible for the cost, but it has the text: players can't untap more than 2 lands during their untap step. And if we know anything about symmetrical effects, they are never symmetrical. The most obvious ways to break symmetry on this are the rail lines, dorks, I wouldn't consider those for the deck I was thinking of, and the sunrise lands that you get to untap on your opponent's turn. The rail lines especially, because they have the ramp mode, I mean, you can turn 2 rail line, turn 3 play Eye of the Barricade and get that down early. And then if you're using sunrise lands, you can then protect it with counter magic on the opponent's turn, things like that. It wouldn't be a core card of a deck, but if you're running a deck that uses all these untap effects, like Rare Lines and Sunrise Lands regardless, you could run a couple of these to kind of gotcha your opponent every now and then.
One thing that this does kind of make me think about is, do we have any good ways of repeatedly tapping lands? Because if we have like a Planeswalker or whatever that can tap lands, or even better, some creature that has a tap ability or whatever to tap lands. Being able to... One of the issues with Winter Orb effects is often your opponent just needs a couple of untaps before they can, like, you know, board wipe or kill this creature or something. And so unless you're getting a pretty good gacha on them, the odds of you generating mana advantage with it is kind of rough. But if you do have the ability to tap their lands down, you can, like, more reliably kind of put them under it.
I used to do that in Modern with Hikari Dust Drinker. The thing the build I was thinking of was blue-white, and then you'd run, like, tax and counter spells, because it's really hard for them to build up the mana to get around your tax and counter spells, because you get to cast multiple of them if needed if they try and stall it out by waiting a few turns.
Cool.
Yeah, that's what I had.
All right.
I really hope this one doesn't get a play.
We already have Priest of Simplicity not seeing play, which I think is generally a bit stronger than this, but... I like some of the suggestions for how to symmetry break. That does make this more interesting. Scribble, or actually, Herzy, why don't you start off with SOU so we can just kind of like snake back and forth.
Okay. So I admit I had a bit of trouble with this one, because SOU feels like one of the sets that people have already kind of looked over moderately thoroughly. But I ended up going with Choking Dunes, which is a red enchantment, 4 generic, 2 red mana. It has, at the beginning of your upkeep, you may discard a card. If you do, draw a card. We don't care about this. The second ability is, at the beginning of your end step, Choking Dune deals X damage to any target, where X is the number of land cards in your graveyard. And historically, things that have been able to make the opponent lose life based on just counting cards in your graveyard have had the ability to just kind of gotcha people. Now, admittedly, Choking Dunes at 6 mana is pretty expensive to get out, but Choking Dunes at 6 mana is also right on the threshold for Eldritch Egg. and if you try and get a bunch of lands in your graveyard, you're already doing a bunch of dumping into the yard. So the idea is that some kind of probably Jund mid-range deck, dump a lot of cards into yard, have like a muck bruise and whatnot, fair game plan, and then just occasionally egg people, use Eldritch Egg and Choking Doom to get like, start doing 7-8 damage to any target every instant.
Yeah, I almost picked this card, but I was like, you know, in a control deck, you can cast it on 5 off of Heart of Zadina, but it really feels like we have better 6 drops to be hard casting. So cheating it out is a clever solution. One thing that I think is like pretty good about this card is the fact that you don't have to go face with it, so it's not just a win con. It also can snipe off creatures or whatever.
Yeah, it's part of why I had the idea of doing a fair game plan around, because it can still support that kind of game.
Yeah, I had the exact same journey with this card as you, where I saw it, and I thought, this is a really good finisher that works through as a removal, but as a 6-mana setup card, as a control player, probably not.
Scribble, what is your pick from SOU?
Oh, so my pick for this one is Imperator Namuzar. I'm bringing that name. It is 2 white-white-blue, so 6 mana for a legendary creature, Lamassu Noble. This one has flying, it's a 4-5, and when it enters the battlefield, search your library for an artifact or enchantment card, reveal it, putting it into your hand, then shuffle. And it also has Civilized, where Lamassu creatures you control get +2/+2 and have hexproof as long as you control an artifact, a creature, and an enchantment. So we've seen Civilized / Concord lists get a pretty decent amount of play throughout at least the last couple of years of MCM that I've been around. But I haven't really seen any of them, at least not that I remember, in a really control sort of lens. They've mostly been mid-range or kind of aggro decks where they're just looking to turn on that threat as soon as possible. But Imperator Namuzar looks like a pretty sweet control top end where you don't need to fill your deck with a critical density of artifacts and enchantments to turn this on, because as a 6-drop, as long as you've drawn one of those things by that turn, then you're golden. And it also tutors for one of those for you anyway. So, for example, you could just have a couple Ray Lines in your deck, and then on turn 6, if you've played one enchantment at some point in the game, you play Namuzar, and then you tutor for your Ray Line, and then you play your Ray Line, bouncing a land to your hand, and then bam, you have a 6/7 flying hexproof. It was giving me kind of vibes of Dream Trawler, where it's just a really big hexproof flying threat that can end the game, but it also can do card selection, not card advantage, but
it's kind of card advantage.
Yeah, so not constant stream of cards, still card advantage.
Yeah, I think that the fact you can you have 5 turns to get it set, you actually have the hexproof is big, because otherwise, it'd just be a beater that gets killed. Yeah, the hexproof does a decent amount to carry it here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that I think is kind of interesting about this card is it feels like the kind of bait option is for you to try to lean too heavily on, like, ooh, I can have a cool, like, toolbox of different things for this to fetch up. But I think the truth is just, we have enough good enchantments for control decks, and probably plenty of artifacts too, like Ostracize or Orb, that you can and probably should just play this as a fair card. Yeah. One kind of neat thing is you can use it to tutor up like a Rippling Curtain or Will of a Fickle Lord to potentially flicker it to get more triggers. That might be a little bit lost in the sauce, but I think probably Rippling Curtain at least is pretty good in this like sort of shell.
Or maybe even Orb of Undoing.
Oh god. I don't want to play another 6 mana for my Imperator Namuzar.
This one actually also has an additional layer of bait where that last ability that pumps and grants hexproof is actually applies to all Lamassu control. So you can go even further into the source and make this a Lamassu tribal card.
Yeah, as you were talking about, I did look up all the Lamassu, and I'm going to be honest, I don't think that's the line.
One thing that's notable is it doesn't say Lamassu creatures you control get +2/+2 and have hexproof. So it protects your polyp pools.
Hell yeah. They'll never imp siege me again.
All right, so my pick for Scriptures of Urshad is a card that I feel like I've mentioned in like several different set reviews or like hypothetical brews, but it's apparently never seen a decklist result, and I don't think I've ever seen it in a GP, but my pick is going to be a card that was one of the scourges of Custom Standard back in the day, which is Tradition. So Tradition is one of the discoveries. It's 2 black-black. The first 2 triggers are mill 2 cards and gain 2 life. And then the final thing is during each of your turns, you may cast a permanent spell from your graveyard. So it's just really easy once this is online to just grind people out in like 20 to 40 different ways. You really do not need to build your deck in a way that makes this like good. It is trivial for it to just be, oh, okay, I'm going to recast my Profane Emissary. I'm going to recast my Kaijo. If you're recasting creatures, technically you're better off on Qigao, but the downside that Qigao has is A, it doesn't set itself up in the way that Tradition does, and B, it only works on one creature name at a time. So Tradition has the ability to, you know, they exile one of the threats, but you play out a different one. Where this card gets kind of egregious is when you also start using it alongside, like, artifacts or enchantments that sacrifice to do a thing. So if you have the ability to, you know, like, I don't think the format has a Pyrite Spell Bomb, but something like that, where you can sacrifice it to deal 2 damage to something.
It has something. There's a Unraveling card I was really interested in, but I couldn't figure out a way to use it. It's a 2-cost red enchantment that whenever a creature enters, it sacks and deals 6 to it.
Oh, Runescribe's Trap or whatever it's called.
Yeah. Loop that with this.
Yeah, there we go. And you also have the ability to, like, regrow Planeswalkers, which I think makes this, like, a really scary top end versus other control decks. Now, 4 mana, you do have to tap out for it. You do have to wait a little bit to get a payoff. The life gain's a little bit nice. It does, like, buy you some time. But I definitely don't think this card is, like, format defining or warping. But I definitely think it should see more than the functionally zero play it's seen.
So I assumed this card had seen a bunch of play, but it might just because I remember people talking about it for Custard or Custom Standard. Like, I think I might have just equated people talking about it as seeing play, so I assumed it was an already known factor.
It had zero decklist results, and I couldn't find anything in the Grand Prix channel when I was searching.
Nice.
So this card did some really silly things in Custom Standard because you could, like, draw step lock people with it because there was an artifact that made people discard when it died, I believe, and there was, you know, a decent sack outlet. So, you know, you could... there was definitely a point where, in addition to just grinding people out, you were now removed their ability to play the game.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so next up we have Alkaba. I'm worried that I'm going to poach Scribble's pick here, but my pick for Alkaba, we should mention, Alkaba is by Zangy, Script Preserver Shod is by Matt, I can't remember, and we mentioned Jan's.
Yeah, one of the weeds.
Okay, so for Alkaba has actually had a lot of cards see play already, including some that are, like, very close to my heart. So the one that I want to pick is one that got a little bit of hype and then saw no play. And I think one of the reasons to see no play is people have misidentified the shell for it. And that's Mahara's Command. So Mahara's Command is one of each non-red color. It's a sorcery. And you choose two. You either return 2 creature cards from your graveyard to your hand, 2 enchantments from your graveyard to your hand, 2 artifacts from your graveyard to your hand, and then target player may put a permanent card from their hand onto the battlefield. So people really just saw that last line of text and said, oh, so this is a show-and-tell card. Show-and-tell doesn't want to play this in the mana base, we're good, and moved on. But I think that's actually, like, really misevaluating this card, because I think where this card shines is actually in fair decks.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to be putting in a 8-drop for this card to be good. If you are using 4 mana to go up up on one card and then put a 5-drop into play, that's kind of an insane effect. So this card is, I think, in my opinion, good enough if you're just recurring, like, 2 medium creatures and putting in a slightly large creature.
Yeah.
And that's not that hard of a deck building threshold to be able to meet.
And if you can even go further and potentially get one where 2 of the recur modes are viable, you can also kind of play as a recur 4.
Yeah, this nice. Is a 1-4 is horrifying.
Yeah, I think I always viewed this card and sort of thought, oh, well, you kind of want to have more than 2 modes in your deck to really be getting value of it. Otherwise, you're substituting value for versatility that doesn't apply to your deck. So if your deck only contains creatures, and so you're just returning creatures, you have to beat something out, then it may as well have half as much text that it has, and then it doesn't really feel like it's worth either the mana cost or pip investment. But it does seem like a really nice fair card, and I think we've had similar effects see play some sort of play before.
I think the way to look at this is it's very similar to cards like Collected Company or Theocracy or these other, like, this is a card that gives you a slight mana advantage and a slight card advantage. And the main thing that this has over those is there is a degree of setup, but it's set up in gameplay and not set up in deck building. So with Collected Company, you need to warp your deck such that when you cast Collected Company, you are X percent likely to hit off of it. And even then, you can still sometimes miss. Whereas with this, if you have creatures in your graveyard, you've hit. And that's a much easier threshold to meet than your deck has to have at least N copies of creatures with CMC X or less.
And in terms of hitting has less text, there's two things there. Like, one is the Alcaba four-color commands kind of are all built around the idea there's one pseudo-locked-in mode and then a bunch of supporting modes. But also, like, the first three modes in this, you can easily just kind of read it as a single mode because they're all doing the same thing, but just targeting different types. So it's pretty straightforward. This tree is, like, basically not even a modal spell. It's recur two things, cheat one out, and then just leave it at that.
I wonder if this could fit into, like, a Tavia shell where you actually into all the multiple types. So you only have a couple of everything, but then you're always pretty likely to at least have one type where you have two cards of that type in your graveyard.
That's better than the suggestion I was going to make, which is, okay, well, if you're willing to add red, this card plays really nice last request.
Four colors is fine, but we're never going to five. Get it together.
Yeah, historically, bad idea in MSC.
I do think that one thing that is true about this card is, this card can kind of be your top end. You don't really need more, like, card advantage-y things if you're running this, other than, like, you know, card advantage-y creatures, which is kind of a different beast.
Yeah, like, as long as you've got three or four-ish that range creatures that have good value to them, yeah, this is more than enough top end, because it just gets you your value creatures back.
All right, Scribble, you want to go next?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you were worried about sniping my pick, but that card costs green mana, so I would never play it. my pick for Alcaba is one of the Elder cycle that Zangy has mentioned wanting to see more play, but I think it hasn't really been touched too much. So this one is Rastard, Word of Truth. So this one is costs 2 blue and red, so 4 mana for a legendary creature called Angel. It's a 4/4, it has prowess, and whenever you cast a non-creature spell, draw a card. But it also has, at the beginning of your end step, if you have 4 or more cards in your hand, transform Rastard, and the back tail is Farib, it's Tale of Deceit, so Legendary Elder Demon. It has Hexproof, it's also a 4/4. It has discard 2 cards. You may cast target instant or sorcery card in your graveyard this turn. If that spell would be put into a graveyard, exile. And at the beginning of your end step, if you have 2 or fewer cards in hand, transform. So I did some of the maths on this to see what a curve would look like where... you want to play Rastard on turn 4 and then be able to flip it into a hexproof creature that same turn. And it's not too unlikely. On the play, you can just play a land a turn and you can cast one interaction spell and one card cantrip. And then you'll be able to flip it when you hit cast it on turn 4. So it's not a huge ask. I think control slash midrange builds of this kind can often get away with casting one interaction spell in the first three turns and one cantrip spell. They often like to do that anyway. And then you've got your Hexproof 4/4, which allows you to turn any two crappy cards in your hand a counterspell or other form of interaction from your graveyard in a way that's face-up as well. So your opponent is kind of just leaning into getting their things answered. And at the same time, it has Hexproof, so you can just hold up a counterspell from your graveyard for edicts or wipes or anything else that can get around the Hexproof. And then once you're out of cards, once you've been trading away all the cards in your hand, specific card selection from your graveyard, then you flip it back and then you have an engine which draws you a card every time you cast an on. It also gets bigger.
Yeah, I think this card has seen like a little bit of play shortly after Alcaba came out. I remember Dr. Batman played it in the list for a little bit. It's always seemed like a cool card. There is a different blue-red plus other colors control finisher in Alcaba that has my heart, but I think this card like has a lot of play to it, and I think the potential to like generate either large amounts of card quality or card advantage, and also Rastad just like beating the crap out of people with prowess, definitely makes it pretty appealing.
Yeah, it's a lot of text, which might be why it doesn't seem big. It's hard to wrap your head around everything it does, but it is one of the cleanest ones for feeding back and forth into each other.
Yeah, they seem like they really lean into it. They play really nicely together. They flip where exactly when you would want the other one. So it seems like this was designed pretty intentionally by Zangy, with the play patterns in mind. And it just hasn't managed to get there in a deck yet, but I could easily see.
All right.
Hi. Mine also costs 4 mana, because that's just how Alcaba do, I guess. But the card I'm going with is the only one I didn't think of a deck around it. I'm just choosing based on the card itself. Is Tempting Shamaran. which costs every color except for green, and it is basically a really juiced up Ravenous Chupacabra. It's also a 2-2. It's also a 2-2, but instead of when it enters, kill something, it's when it enters, gain control of something, untap it, it gains haste, and at the beginning of the next end step, you then exile that thing you stole and put X +1/+1 counters on Tempting Shamaran, where X is that creature's power. And then it also permanently gains any of that creature's activated abilities, which probably isn't super relevant. It's just the main thing of this is a Ravished Chupacabra where instead of killing, you active treason it and then kill it and then get bigger from it. It seems like a pretty, if you're in these colors, it's a pretty good creature-based kill spell.
This one doesn't cost green.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this one seems pretty sweet.
I do actually think that it not being green is a little bit of a problem, because when I think of like decks that are good at utilizing creatures very effectively, I usually want to be in green, like so I have a way of tutoring the creatures or whatever. But with that acknowledgement put aside, I think that this card like does have a lot of juice to it, and we've seen, you know, flicker decks be powerful in the past. I'm sure that if this card was like a demon, we would have seen a shit ton of it already. Snake Warlock.
Quick, change it.
Maybe a little bit harder. But it's really interesting. Feels really brutal versus other fair creature decks. I feel like this is the sort of card that I always play against like three copies of in any game of Limited.
Yeah, it just stood out as a massive Chupacabra.
Is this more of a sideboard card? Because the ETB, it's mandatory target. So if it's the only thing on the battlefield, then it will kill itself.
But at least it swings for two?
I did notice that. But I feel like in terms of questioning if it's a sideboard card, it's in theory as fitting a mainboard card as any creature kill spell.
That is true.
Assuming your curve handles it, but...
You could also play it, like, in some Dreamsight, like, large deck sort of thing, where you have it as a one or two of that you can tutor up when you need it.
Mm.
But, yeah, this is a juiced card. All right, Scribble, why don't you kick us off with Elmari into the Abyss by Dodger.
Sweet, yeah. So this set, there's a bunch of cards that I'm familiar with because I've run mostly some cycling decks that were built pretty specifically around Elmari cards in the past. There are some really sweet options there. And the way Dodger designs, tend to see a lot from his sets. And one of the cards that I want to highlight from Elmari is a card that I have touched before, but I don't think anyone else has used, and that is Elmari's Grandeur. So this one is an enchantment for one and a red, and it has cycling too, and it's a cycling build around where during each of your turns, you may cast a card with a cycling ability from your graveyard by discarding a card in addition to paying its other cost. If that spell would be put into your graveyard, exile it instead. So what this is it is an enchantment that turns, in the late game, it turns all of your land draws and other dead draws into live draws from your graveyard. So you can retrieve any removal spell or interaction spell from your graveyard if you need it. And if you don't, then you can just swap those cards out for creatures or other gas from your graveyard. Specifically with creatures, since the clause exiles the spell if it would be put into your graveyard, as long as the creature spell doesn't get countered, if your opponent removes it, then you can just recast that creature during your next turn by discarding whatever drew that following turn. So it's a really nice way of ensuring that you have gas in the late game, especially since the cycling creatures and other cycling win conditions have the benefit of if you draw them in the early game and you're not close to casting, just cycle them away. And then this lets you rebuy them later as well when you have the mana and the time to play them. It also works really nicely with things like Circling Predators, which is a cycling sweeper spell that gets bigger whatever cards with cycling you have in your graveyard. And then, yeah, you can just also sub it out for any of the cheap removal spells that have cycling as well. And then this card also has cycling too. So if you draw it early on and you really need something that's not an engine right now, if you need some interaction, you can just get rid of it. And the cycling deck just has really nice redundancy in that regard. And I think this card was built around a lot.
Yeah, one thing that is kind of cool about this card is cycling is not a super uncommon keyword. MSGM only has a few sets with it, but I think it is more likely that we get more sets with cycling than not. So this card has a lot of ability to grow. I played against Rowan, who was running this card in the league deck, and I definitely had at least one game where I was just completely ground out by repeatedly recasting some, like, 5-5 for 4, whatever.
Nice.
But yeah, I also wonder if there's any of the Alara like cycling matters cards like Disturb the Riddle Gate that could be good in this sort of shell.
I've tried building the cycling deck a couple times, and I think there isn't quite the critical mass of cycling cards, of good cycling cards yet, to make Disturb the Riddle Gate as you'd like. But I think there are plenty of solidly individually.
For what? Four sets with prominent cycling cards? Elmer, Alara, Ridio, and then Act has basic land cycling.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I think also cycling becoming evergreen. So we had a couple of cards retroactively gain cycling, like RVO has some, as you mentioned. There's like one random card in Animus Vox with it. There's some unplayable land or unplayable cards from KZD with it. Yeah.
Oh, the type cycles. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Hersey, what is your pick for Elmare?
Also a cycling build around. I'm bookending this with another 1-mana, 1/2 card advantage engine. This card is Glum Orfish. Costs a green mana, 1/2 as mentioned, has cycling 2. It's an enchantment creature. Whenever you cycle a card, reveal the top 2 cards of your library. You may put a permanent card from among them into your hand, put the rest on top of your library in any order or into your graveyard. So every time you cycle, you draw a card as long as it's a permanent.
Oh, that seems really good.
Yeah, because I was looking at this like, just in general, I think you get a 1-drop base to draw you cards. That's great. And I was thinking about how people were talking about, this is why I know about which sets have cycling, because I was looking up cards for this. Act has that a most important prince with its basic land cycling trigger, which will now draw you 2 cards and make the opponent discard. Helion Devastator is a classic cycling playable card. Like, the idea is you wouldn't run extra cycling cards. You just try and build a deck that uses good cards that happen to have cycling already. I like Promethean Grotto. And then if you're in a most important prince deck, you can then go for an Unearth build. And the fact you have cycling cards and the fact you have that Glum Orfish dump stuff in yard also helps with the Unearth game plan. And yeah, I just thought, who doesn't love a 1-mana engine?
And it's also like, if you top deck it in the late game and you needed literally anything else, it does have cycling. So yep. There's only so bad that it can be. I think also Cast Out is a card that's really easy to overlook in these sorts of shells. That's really good.
Yeah. I did have that actually open in a tab, but then ultimately decided the Jund colors seemed better.
That makes sense.
Cast Out is also a good option. What's yours, dearest Pitts?
Yeah, so my final pick is a card that I was really excited for in kind of when the set was initially entering MCM, but I only built a couple of decks with it, and it never really went anywhere. But it has some of my most favorite words on any card that any card can have, which is, put any number of some type of card from among them into your hand. So we have Truth Beyond Belief, which is 5
this one.
Instant pressure, 2 blue-blue. You can cast it if you have 7 more cards in your graveyard. Reveal the top 7 cards of your library. Put any number of non-creature, non-land cards from among them into your hand and the rest into your graveyard. So this is largely overshadowed by Gaze Deeper. And I think kind of for good reason. Gaze Deeper's 5-mana mode is like much more castable than 7-mana. 3-mana being cheaper than 4, obviously kind of real. The fact you don't have to go all in to cast Gaze Deeper is really nice. But with all of that said, drawing like 4-ish cards rather than 3 cards is also a very notable difference. And Truth Beyond Belief, when you swing high with this card, it just seems unbeatable. The fact it doesn't pick up lands is like a little bit inconvenient, but ultimately fine. I've tried to build a couple Ride the Storm decks in the past, but I think this card is like substantially more easily executed than Ride the Storm. And I think there's room to try playing this in a couple of shells.
It picks up lands if your lands are Promethean Grotto.
True, and also if they are real lands.
Yeah, so that one's actually real.
And also if they are a Journey Begin.
So true.
It does have a thing where it would really exasperate your control mirror issues, considering how bad this is to get countered, but...
I do think that in the control mirrors, though, there's some amount of, like, jockeying where you're running out, like, draw spells on their end step, but you really don't want your draw spells to be counterable in general in control mirrors, and I think in control mirrors, you do sometimes actually end up with 7-mana and can cast the hard cast it.
Sure. Or especially game one, you can have, like, I have a handful of kill spells in this virtually creatures control mirror. I don't mind if those get discarded.
That's a good point. Like, it does emotionally feel really bad to discard your hand there, but it's probably not that big of a deal. The fact that it's not drawing cards might come up in some circumstances, whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. Like, it dodges
lay bare
conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if this wants to be in a kind of control deck where it runs less card advantage spells in general, and it just sort of runs the one-for-one cantrips interaction spells, where in the matchups where that those interaction is really important, then you're going down on your hand size anyway, casting all your cards to deal with your opponent's stuff, and then you probably don't have any cards left to discard to, from your hand just to cast the pressure cost. But then against the control decks where you're not casting as many things and you're sort of waiting for someone to blink first, then you could just eventually get to 7 mana and just cast this anyway. Your opponent is pretty forced to respond to that point and then have your next turn's worth of mana pretty much uncontested.
I think in general, and this does get into a more like format philosophy-y thing, MSCM control decks right now, I think, gravitate towards cheaper sources of card advantage and like kind of two-for-one style gameplay, whereas this encourages like very much a one-for-one, one-for-one, one-for-one. Then I generate like +4 or +5 cards out of nowhere. And I think those control decks are really sweet to see on occasion. So I would be kind of excited to see them around. But I think there are a couple of cards in the format that make it very hard to justify playing those sorts of decks, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right.
This isn't really any specific cards. This is just now that we're done with these sets. And when you open this up, because you told us there's a bruise course. When you open this up and said you're specifically focusing on old sets, I'm clearly too old in this format, because I want, like, Elmer is not old, Alcabar is not old.
Yeah.
The new sets.
Alcabar, I believe, is right on the border of the two-year mark that I set initially. There's another episode of The Other Modern that I just finished recording with Egg, where we talked about how his first champion win in Grand Prix Alexandria is closing in on 7 years ago, which was a very upsetting thing to realize.
I thought you were going to say your podcast that you're with Egg was the inverse of our one, where since Egg is a really old player and really old in general, focusing on the newer sets.
We've got these new sets full of cards.
Cards that Egg has never played because he's a player. So.
One thing that I was impressed by, also looking at these old sets, is how many cards from these older sets have seen play or still actively see play to this day? Like, I think there's a lot of discourse around Power Creep and MSCM, but like PSA has plenty of cards that can still hang. Same thing for like Scriptures of Urshad has so many really strong cards in it. And I think if you ever feel like things are getting a little bit stale in the format, definitely just like pop open one of these older sets and just like start scrolling through, because you'll probably find something that is either underexplored or, like, you know, someone explored it when the set first dropped, but then dropped it after a couple of months. MSCM has also grown a lot since a lot of these sets were released. So even if the cards were, you know, present and explored by the format when we had like 8 to 10 people in any given GP, it's a very different situation now.
Yeah.
I think the three of us specifically being pretty big brewers, especially of the older cards, you know, just this exercise, just going through older sets. I'm not sure how you guys were looking at it, but I was just sort of slapping the minus is playable tag in Instigator. I know the stat decks isn't completely up to date anymore, but just eliminating the cards that have consistently seen play and just being able to go through the cards in the sets that haven't historically seen as much, there was still a lot of cards that seem quite playable, and it's just, you know, they maybe got slightly outcast by other cards that Sue see play, but still could absolutely play on their own. And then I think it's pretty noteworthy that we all sort of revolved around build arounds for the most part in this exercise. So there's just a lot going on in those older sets where you could absolutely just pick a build around from older sets and slap some cards around, make it work. Doesn't seem unviable.
Yeah. The using that minus is playable would have been the smart thing for me to do. I just power swirled.
Yeah, I just relied on my own memory there. Especially because Cajun now has is playable and is staple working. Definitely could have and should have used those things.
Well, I figured because I'm a newer player to the format than you, that my memory probably wasn't as reliable in terms of the older sets to be able to figure out, what has actually seen play or not.
Yeah.
There you go. Way to turn it around to a compliment to us.
Thank you guys both for joining me. Hopefully people enjoy this episode, and I definitely would love to do more in the style in the future, since, you know, there's a lot of sets in the format, and going back and constantly kind of pulling through them and seeing what's in there feels like it could be really promising.
Yeah, there's a couple more sets, one or two out there.
A few, one might say.
Yeah, right. Brewing's exciting, and it's always nice to see more people.
Thanks everyone for listening. See you in the next episode.
Goodbye.